Saturday, August 1st. Mayor Wagner and his two sons, Robert Jr. and Duncan, arrived about noon, and this is one of the times when it's so marvelous to have Lindbergh here, because we dispatched her to greet them, since that was the time that Lyndon and I had to go to the memorial service for Senator Claire Ingalls out at Fort Myer Chapel. The Reverend Frederick Brown Harris, chaplain of the Senate, held the service. What a lot of them he's presided over, living and dead. It was a brief, non-denominational sort of service. Lyndon and I sat in the front row on one side, and Lou, looking stonily calm, sat with Claire's brother, so like Claire that it gave me quite a start, sat in the front row on the other. When it was over, everybody waited for us to leave, but I asked Dr. Harris if I could step over and say a word to Lou. She's lived through a tortured year and been very courageous, and part of the worst of it was the pressure from California leaders for the senator to get out of the race. The chapel was full, but not overflowing. We got back home to find that the Wagners were waiting lunch for us, and it was 2 o'clock. We sat down with Linda and Dave, and I asked Philip to eat with us, just about one of the first family meals he sat down to with us. And Kern Wildenthal, Jesse Kellum's nephew, studying to be a doctor and almost a prodigy, already being through medical school and doing his internship at 22. And then I had the most self-indulgent afternoon. Curled up in bed and read the book about Wilson's last days, when the cheering stopped. Not exactly good therapy for anybody who finds themselves in the presidency, because it's proof that it's a killing job. And his heartbreak over the failure of the Congress to accept the League of Nations is very poignantly told, as is also his great blindness in not working with the Senate. Long, long before the time came. To me, he emerges from this book a noble man, at times even a gay man, but a man with no concept of the role of the legislative body in this nation's government. For dinner, we had invited Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, Tony Celebrezze, and his soft-voiced wife, Anne, humorous and incisive Willard Wirtz, fast getting to be one of my favorites, and I never thought I would like anybody as Secretary of Labor as well as I did Arthur Goldberg and his wife, Jane, because these two have most to do, that is, their parts of the federal government have most to do, the situation Mayor Wagner faces in New York. And the Dick Goodwins came, young, bright, a legacy from the Kennedys, and apparently willing to really work with the Johnsons. I had arranged, with Lucy's advice and consent, for dinner downstairs for the young folks, dates with Beth Jenkins and Ann Hutchinson for the two Wagner boys, and with Congressman Lindley Beckwith's daughter, Mary, for Philip. And then they were going out to Shady Grove to see Dionne Carroll in No Strings. We sat on the Truman balcony for a drink or two before going into dinner. Talked of Mayor Wagner's 3-day vacation, poor man, in Mallorca, where he had gone to spend a long, restful time with a friend who had a house in that, what I hear is a lovely spot. And then he was summoned back to the maelstrom. He talked of some of the problems. He believed that the Reverend Martin Luther King is the only one his folks up there will listen to. He has a sort of an emotional hold over them, apparently, that Roy Wilkins and Whitney Young don't. He talked of the heavy amount of unemployment in Harlem, of how the city had promised to give 1,300 jobs to youngsters out of school, working in the parks, various cleanup jobs around the city. This, of course, is just a drop in the bucket. And this, it's a hard fact to disclose, and he was doing so only privately. But he said there were 55 different government-sponsored organizations to prevent school dropouts. I think he meant county, state, local, and maybe private programs that had some sort of government approval, but all of which were supposed to touch the lives of those people in Harlem. And they were trying to condense them into a few really effective ones that got the job done. He said also they had allotted $1 million for a rat eradication program. He spoke dishearteningly of the enormous amount of public housing that New York City has and how the houses are not kept up after the tenants have been in them for some years. It was a very discouraging picture, but the more he talked, the more you felt that it was one that was being battled. From the outside, I had wondered why they did not have a People's Review Board of police brutality. He said if one were instituted, the morale of his department would drop to zero overnight. because they would think they would just be in the hands of stirrers up of trouble. Draft of speech for Mrs. Johnson to deliver at breakfast at Democratic Convention. Good morning. As I look out over this group, I see a number of you who are my personal friends. We have traveled a long trail together and been through a lot of things, some of them delightful, some tragic, and some downright hilarious. I, for one, have fared, on balance, mighty well at the hands of the mass media. I envy you a bit, particularly right now. As I think most of you know, when I was in college, I was a journalism major. I was going to be where the exciting things were happening with people who were making them happen. Well, along came a young man named Lyndon, and here I am furnishing copy instead of competing with you for stories. This morning in Atlantic City is the beginning of a hectic period for me. It is the first of many mornings that will melt into days and nights of hurried and blurring succession. But let me say to you that I am glad and grateful to have the opportunity to play a role in this campaign. The writer E.B. White has remarked, "Democracy is the recurrent suspicion that more than half of the people are right more than half of the time. This is our faith when we go to the people and ask for their support. To me, the whole process is fascinating and exciting. But let me revert to my college dream of being a journalist. Let me see if I can guess your questions and answer some of them. Will I be campaigning with the president? I will be traveling with the president while he campaigns. I will go with him for three main purposes. Trying to give him a link to home life and a quiet moment and a companion. I will go to try to thank the many people who are working so hard for us. The volunteer work, the organization, the sheer hours of work never fail to impress me. I want those people to know we care and we thank them. I will try to act as a conduit or link between the president and the people he represents. I will act as a reporter to my husband on the opinions and aspirations and moods and problems the people have. Actually, in many ways, I am a reporter, on a closed circuit, of course, or for a very private editor, because I try to report to him factually what I see and hear in places I visit, and I try to give him insight into the feeling of those I meet. Sometimes I will be taking trips to places where the president is unable to go because of the all-consuming nature of the job he has. And with the limitations outlined, would certainly be saying something. I am no orator, as everybody knows who's ever heard me. I will leave the deeply involved speeches on the issues of the campaign to others. Will the girls be campaigning? They will participate in ways suitable to their age and without conflicting with their schooling. Lucy, who will have a hard enough time getting through her senior year in high school, and Linda will be back in her third year in college. But they will be intensely interested in and very grateful for the work of the Young Citizens for Johnson, and will attend any of the barbecues or meetings with these young citizens during the fall, as they have during this past month. Will I try to see that the president does not overexert himself during the campaign? Like any wife, I am constantly concerned with his welfare. But the president, who is not the most docile of human beings, is sensibly enough my ally rather than my adversary on a reasonable program of diet, exercise, and relaxation. More now than ever before. He assumes that a prime responsibility of a president of the United States is to be physically prepared for the job. Will the women's vote tend to support one candidate more than another? I have never been able to detect the alleged women's vote singly and alone. I don't believe we are a herd of cows chomping along behind some petticoat general. What does it all mean to me? Simply, a chance to work for your country. I see this decade of the 60s as a unique time when, as never before, mankind has the tools to make a better life with the next few decades than he has with the last few centuries. And my husband is the sort of man who wants to get in there and push. I never fail to get a great spiritual lift, a sense of renewal from campaigns. Campaigns bring the candidate and his wife, as a part of the team, into close touch with the people, their problems and aspirations and their mood. For the president and me, they have never failed to give us a renewed sense of reality, a new sense of service, that the work that we're doing is important and vital, and I think in your determination to do the best that we can to help create a better world and a happier nation. When I think of the work to be done, I think of simple pictures. I think of a job retraining center in West Virginia that we saw, where young unemployed girls, 17 to 21 or so, were being taught such things as typing and shorthand, and beautician's work. I think there'll always be a market for that. And young men were being taught automobile mechanics and carpentry. I think of that trip to the West I took recently, where a dam was being dedicated to conserve that most precious resource, water, for irrigation and to produce hydroelectric power, part of a long, long planning for this nation's richness. I think of the work of unfinished America. My husband wants to put his hand to it, and I want to help.